Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine speak with Nora Reitner. She's a clinical oncology social worker at the Yale Cancer Center, and she joins us to speak about the role of caregivers in the cancer treatment process.
Nora, the definition of a caregiver for a cancer patient is rather broad. Maybe we can start off by reviewing with our listeners, you know, what you think is the essence of caregivers and who the key caregivers are.
Sure. I think that we have to differentiate between family caregivers and paid caregivers. First of all, I think oftentimes paid caregivers are the ones who are coming into the home on a regular basis through some sort of an agency. But the real caregivers that we're talking about are the family caregivers. And when I say family, that's where it gets broad. I think that we have caregivers for our patients that really run the gamut from everything from a spouse to sometimes a neighbor and everything in between, sons, daughters, husbands, wives, friends, grandparents sometimes, a series of people, even sometimes a friend or a neighbor or a series of friends or neighbors, depending on who the people resources are that the patient has.
So I guess it really would depend upon the particular patient's own situation as to which family member, which neighbor might be the key caregiver.
Exactly. And sometimes patients start out with just needing a little bit of help from a neighbor who drives them to their appointments and has no one else in the area. And then sometimes we really have to look around and talk with the patient and talk with family members from across the country as their caregiving needs become greater.
So sometimes you actually facilitate a patient identifying who their caregivers could potentially be.
That's a very important part of our role. I think very often when patients live alone, and we're seeing a lot of them, and they don't really realize what the course of their treatment's going to be, but we know that there are going to be times when they're going to need a lot more care than they may think at the onset, and we immediately start thinking about that very early on, trying to identify with them people who can be helpful to them.
And Nora, I know that you and your colleagues really spend a great deal of time also trying to incorporate the so-called paid caregivers as part of the team, because obviously it's important to have individuals who have expertise in taking care of cancer patients. And maybe you can just say a word about who those particular paid caregivers are that are going to be involved.
Oftentimes, when patients, particularly who have been hospitalized, go home, they need additional home care services than what they had before. It can be a real shock to patients and caregivers that, mom was just driving last Wednesday, and now you're telling me that she can't go home and live alone. She needs home care services in the house. It can really be a shock to people to realize that level of care need can change so quickly. So there are many agencies out there, usually covered by insurance, that can be tapped into to help for the patient at home. And those are the paid caregivers. In addition, if people feel that they need more help, they can pay privately for additional help as well.
So Norma, can you tell us a little bit about how a patient could tap into the services of a social worker in terms of setting up this kind of caregiver system?
If they're in the hospital, it's very easy, where we see most of the patients, and the care coordinators who actually set up the service see all of the patients and assess for their home care needs along with physical therapy and the medical team. And any patient that is in need of any kind of home care services would be identified and services would be set up for them if they were agreeable to that. When they come into the clinic, it's a little bit different because they're more independent and more capable, and if they're usually not in need of home care services at that time, but that's not always, and any of the doctors can talk with the social workers anytime about becoming involved with a patient who they feel may need more service at home. In addition to the home care agencies, there's other agencies like Area on Aging that can help with homemaker services and different things like that if the patients qualify.
Now, Nora, once a patient leaves the hospital, and if a caregiver should have, you know, any issues, concerns, questions, would they go back to you and your colleagues who really are focused on the inpatient side of things, or are there social workers who kind of take care of the outpatient issues, if you will?
That's a good question. We have inpatient and outpatient social workers. There's outpatient social workers in the clinic, inpatient in the hospital. And if, for example, we were referring to an agency like a visiting nurse association and there was some additional need at home, we can refer also to the social workers in the home care agencies. But that's all for the patients. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the caregivers, who are sometimes the ones that are really under stress as well. We started out talking about how they could be, you know, a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, a neighbor. And the social workers really try to make a point of helping the caregivers as well. Oftentimes they are the family members, and oftentimes they are the people who live with the patient. Not always. But even if they are or they aren't, they can be under an enormous amount of stress and really in uncharted territory when it comes to taking care of a person who has a now chronic illness and is potentially becoming more and more ill.
Now, now patients have support groups, right, to help get them through the process. Do caregivers have a similar type of support network, support groups that can also help them get their way through the process?
Absolutely. We really see our service as being to the patient and family. And we are constantly developing new support groups because one of the most important things for patients and caregivers is to be able to talk to other people that are in that same boat. Currently, there are 11 support groups running, and many of them we've set up as patient and caregiver support groups. We find that that works out pretty well because when you try to have a caregiver support group, oftentimes the caregivers who have the most need are the ones who can't come because they can't leave their patient and they don't have anyone to leave their patient with. So we do have a number of patient and family support groups, and we can often then break it down into two separate mini groups, the patient and the caregiver, which works very well.
So are some of these so-called virtual groups such that patients could actually call in or call other patients or other caregivers could interact with each other if they can't actually come to these meetings?
That's an excellent point. With the new technology that we have nowadays, anybody that has a computer can be in a support group. We don't do any virtual support groups here yet, but there are a lot of virtual support groups out there online through organizations like the Leukemia Lymphoma Society and through Cancer Care. Any patient or family member that has a need for that or asks about that or wants to ask us about that, we can hook them up with those kind of support groups. And they're very valuable for patients and caregivers who can't get out. If they're just out there not connected with us at all, they can go to their computer and Google cancer support groups in Connecticut, and they will likely get referred to the cancer agencies that have their websites up and running with all kinds of information on them.
So, Nora, I've heard the statistic that actually 1 in 5 adults is caring for a sick family member. Is that really true?
It's certainly true. I think there are many more caregivers out there than we even know about. We're just dealing with cancer here, but you have people out there taking care of relatives with Alzheimer's, stroke victims, all kinds of illnesses, and the caregivers are kind of the hidden story. There's been a lot of research recently about caregivers and the fact that they tend to neglect their own health. They tend to suffer from chronic conditions at twice the rate of normal. And they don't bother to go to see their own doctors because they're too busy taking their patients or loved ones to their appointments.
So is there any advice that you typically give to loved ones and or other caregivers as to how they can be sure not to let their own physical and emotional well-being kind of get hurt and sacrificed in the process of helping their loved one?
That's a very, very important point, and I think one that we have to stress here today. If we take one thing away from this, or if any caregiver is listening takes one thing away from listening today, it's that you really do need to take care of yourself. And I know I've had people tell me, everybody says that, but what do I do? It's a lot of things that you can do. You need to take respite breaks. You need to be tuned in to your own needs. You need to assess yourself as often as you assess your loved one for any kind of symptoms of depression or any other kind of illness. You have to be able to ask for help and learn how to accept it when it's offered. That can be the hardest thing. And you need to recognize that you have rights too. And finally, I think it's important to say you have to be able to forgive yourself for not being perfect. Very often caregivers are very, very hard on themselves. They think that they're not doing enough or that they maybe got a little angry and short with the patient the other day and they feel very bad about that. You're actually doing a really incredible job. And the most important thing that I would say that you can do for yourself is look for a support group. Talk to other caregivers, find out that, you're really doing a really pretty good job.
So, Nora, is it harder for a patient with cancer and their caregivers to deal with the illness than it is, say, for somebody with diabetes or heart disease? And what are the special issues that the caregivers of cancer patients have to face?
I think that in some ways it is harder. I think that cancer is a very devastating illness, and I think that it tends to be or can be a very long, drawn-out illness where the caregivers get very worn out. I think that they are not sure how that's going to go when they first get into it. And then as the patient has more and more needs, they get in deeper and deeper, and they aren't prepared, and they haven't been doing those things like asking for the help that they need. I think at those points, they need to really recognize that they're in need of help. And that's where support groups can come in, and that's where social workers can come in. Caregivers need to speak up. They're dealing with a devastating illness in a loved one, and it can just really sink the boat. I think that they really need to know that there are people out there that can help them, that can steer them in the right direction, and that can get them the support that they need.
I'm just curious, what are your general recommendations, Nora, for, say, end of life issues? I know a lot of family members and friends, you know, have had loved ones who've had cancer kind of at the end stage. And then there's always this very intense discussion about whether or not to keep mom or dad home for home care, or to then send them to inpatient hospice, such as what we have, you know, out in Brantford, Connecticut Hospice, which really is a terrific facility. And it's always a struggle for family members to kind of decide what to do, in obviously having the discussion with the patient. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are as to how to approach that discussion.
I think my thoughts would be that the discussion doesn't happen soon enough, that a lot of times it is, as you say, a very difficult discussion to have, and it's one that people tend to avoid. And then in the end, they often wind up feeling very regretful that they didn't have the discussion earlier on, because now they really don't know what mom or dad would have wanted, or they don't know what their spouse would have wanted, or they don't know what their a partner would have wanted. And I think that it needs to be an earlier on discussion. I think that, first of all, we try now to get all patients to participate in making and discussing advance directives, and letting their loved ones know what their wishes would be. I think at that same time, and it's especially true for the caregivers who are not an immediate relative, that the patient needs to speak up and say who they would want to be their surrogate decision maker if it comes down to the fact that they can no longer make decisions for themselves, so that the caregiver can be empowered, especially if they're not a relative. Situations come up where the person that they wanted to be their surrogate decision maker is trumped by a family member who comes in from out of town, and it's the person is not the person that the patient would have wanted. Having those discussions earlier is one way to do that.
So, Nora, we're making a lot of very important points here, and I'd like to get back to a couple of these issues after the break. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers. We're discussing the patient support system with Nora Reitmer.
Breast cancer is the second most common cancer in women. About 3,000 women in Connecticut will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and new therapies are providing more options for breast cancer patients, and more women are able to live with breast cancer than ever before. Beginning at age 40, every woman should schedule an annual mammogram, and you should start even sooner if you have a risk factor associated with breast cancer. Screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle are the most important factors in defeating breast cancer. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to make new treatments not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration available to patients. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Nora Reitmer, a clinical oncology social worker at the Yale Cancer Center. So, Nora, we were talking a little bit about end-of-life decisions and directives, and talking about interactions between caregivers and the patient. But I'd like to switch gears a little bit now and talk about the relationship between the caregiver and the physician. So the physician obviously interacts with the patient, but I'm wondering, should the physician also be interacting directly with the caregiver, or should that communication go directly from the caregiver to the patient and vice versa?
That's a very important question, and I think it's a very individual answer. I would have to say that there are some patients who really don't want their caregivers too involved, at least initially. And if they're fine and healthy and able to interact with their physician and to make decisions and everything, that they should be able to do that. There are some patients who are really not able to do that, and in which case the physician has to interact mostly with the caregiver. But I think that probably the best way to do it is to have the physician interacting with the caregiver and the patient at the same time. If the patient would allow, the caregiver should be with the patient, if at all possible, at most appointments. It's always good to have a second set of ears. And we encourage patients to bring their caregivers with them to appointments to talk with the doctor so that when they leave, they can discuss it and they can one can remember what the other one doesn't. They say it's very effective to do it this way, and many times patients and caregivers find that they remembered or heard different things. If that's the case, they can check back with the physician because it's very, very important information that they're trying to understand.
You know, I think that really is a key point that you just raised, because I think there have been some studies looking at, you know, how much information a patient will kind of retain after they see their physician. I think some estimates are at most 10 or 15% of the conversation actually is retained, understood. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of patients who come with their caregivers to see me in the clinic, their caregiver will either bring a tape recorder or, you know, a notebook and take down notes, as well as perhaps have questions that they've thought about beforehand. And I think that really is very important to try to enhance communication between patient, caregiver, physician.
It's an important role for the caregiver to be that backup guy.
So, Nora, how does the physician know what the status of the caregiver is? And how do we know whether a caregiver might be getting overwhelmed or depressed? Are there signals that we should be looking for? And how would you advise that we go about actually counseling the caregiver? I know that I've run into situations where I've had family members come in and I've talked to them about some of these issues like depression and anxiety.
I think it's very wonderful that the doctors are looking out for the caregivers too. And yes, there are certainly signs and symptoms, just like you would notice in your patient. If a caregiver is seeming overwhelmed, they tend to be, you know, perhaps disheveled. They tend to be forgetful. They tend to be having difficulty. They may start talking with you and start crying. Sometimes it's pretty easy to see that the caregiver is pretty stressed. Other things that you might do is ask them a few questions about how it's going at home and how are you taking care of yourself and, you know, have you been eating and sleeping? Something we can't use to judge depression in oncology patients because none of them can eat or sleep. But the caregivers are able to do that, and if they say they're not doing those things or if they look, you know, like they're pretty grim and they don't smile and they can't, you know, really look you in the eye, I would start to get worried and ask them if perhaps they might want to talk to somebody about what's going on or get some support. Coming from the physician, I think it can be a very, very important thing because they would take it seriously.
You know, obviously taking care of a loved one with cancer can be a pretty intense experience. And so do you give any tips to caregivers as to how they can kind of stay upbeat and remain positive, you know, throughout this whole process?
I think we're back to taking care of themselves again. I think that's the most important thing. And the other thing that they can do is they can write things down. They can really write down their worries. They can write down tasks that they have to accomplish. And they can, I used to tell caregivers, keep a list by the phone so when people call up and say, what can I do? You can say, oh, you know what you can do? You could take my car out and get me some gas. I'm on empty. I had a caregiver one time who I just thought, it just really got to me. She said, if only I had someone who could come over on Monday nights and put my garbage out. And I thought, bingo, these little things that just really put people over the edge because they've got all these things to tend to, if they could start portioning them out to their friends and relatives. If each friend or relative could do one of those things, it would be really helpful.
I think that's a very good point. And what we're really talking about here is the caregiver developing their own network. Just like they've developed a network for the patient, they also need to develop a network for themselves.
Absolutely. And they have to be able to accept the help. And sometimes people out there mean very well, but they don't know what to offer. I'd also suggest to people who know families who have cancer that they try to come up with things to offer. But if they're not able to, as many are not, if the caregiver could really write down a list and keep it by the phone.
I think, as you said, one of the real challenges that I think we've all seen, you know, in our daily practice is that caregivers sometimes find it very difficult to say they need help, and that they view that as a weakness on their part.
Yes.
But in fact, that's probably the most important thing. If in fact they feel overwhelmed and they need help, they need to seek help.
It's actually a strength to recognize that you need some help and to be able to organize yourself to find the things that you can get help with. But I agree. I think that they feel like, how could I need help? Here is my loved one who's suffering so much, and I'm perfectly fine and healthy. You know, I can deal. But you won't be able to deal for very long if you don't make sure that you take care of yourself as well.
One of the unique issues with being a caretaker for a cancer patient is that after the patient passes on, the issues for the caregiver really continue. And in many instances, the caregiver may in fact feel guilty about things that they didn't do. I think it's really important for us to continue to think about the caregiver even after the patient has passed on. And can you talk a little bit about some of those special issues that those caretakers may have?
I think that there are special issues. You're talking about a person who has had a lot of their life taken up with taking care of their loved one, and now their loved one is gone, and they are just completely at loose ends in addition to being in really heavy bereavement. I think that, again, I would recommend groups as a solution. There are bereavement groups for people who are really having an extremely difficult time with the bereavement, which is not at all unusual if you've been living with cancer for a number of years. And I think that it's also important to realize that, you know, you're going to have to take some time before life starts to feel the new normal again. It's not going to be back to normal ever, but it'll be a new normal, and you will be able to get your life back together in a way that you sometimes have a greater appreciation for life. You've been through almost a traumatic experience that leaves you with some, you know, existential questions, some sense of meaning in life that perhaps not going through that experience would not, you know, be the case.
It's interesting that I guess in the newest definition of cancer survivor, it's not just the patient who survives cancer, but now it also includes the loved ones and the caregivers who've been in some way touched by taking care of a patient with cancer.
That's very interesting. Yes, I agree 100%.
And are there any situations, Nora, which you might recommend, in addition to obviously seeking, you know, the group counseling, you know, perhaps therapy with, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, and perhaps seek out, you know, medical help, if you will, for those issues?
Yes, it depends. I mean, there are certainly people who go into the experience of being a cancer caregiver a little bit more vulnerable than other people just by virtue of where they were in their life. And if they start to have really symptoms of depression and anxiety that's unrelenting, it's certainly a good idea that they seek help. Psychiatrists can provide medication, psychologists, social workers and nurses can provide counseling, and it's never a bad idea to have that kind of service available to you if you're going through a difficult time and you're feeling particularly vulnerable.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guest, Nora Reitmer, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.